Nobody here is deceiving anybody. Now this takes counsel, takes direction. Above all, it takes a lot of grace from God. Let me first point out what the young religious should be told. They should be told not to judge immediately by the external conduct of others. Father Daniel Lord, about whom I'm sure you've heard, used to say, and the phrase we had was, the older fathers, by which we meant those who already were, say, under final vows. By the time we take our final vows, we are older. That older fathers seem to be less virtuous than they actually are. Novices seem to be more virtuous than they actually are. And I think there's a lot to it. Sometimes the people before their last vows can just be disarmingly edifying. What a beautiful religious. A budding John Berkman's, or if she's a nun, Jean Berkman's. How beautiful, how modest, how well behaved, how prayerful, how devout, how beautifully submissive to the will of God as manifested through superiors. Give her 6 weeks after first vows, and you may be surprised. So firmness, in spite of bad example. And this is not only to have the vocations persevere, because if they don't, the community is in trouble. This is also to, for example, invite vocations. And the same thing that turns off a religious under first vows can turn away people whom we have thought about the religious life but are simply not interested in the kind of life they see practiced by people who are supposed to be religious. So first, to be sure to tell the people not to judge by externals. But secondly, to recognize, yes, there are people who are not living edifying religious lives. I have the advantage from childhood on. I remember once, whatever the occasion was, but my mother took me to talk to my teacher, a sister of Notre Dame. I remember her name, Sister Augusta. Whatever the conversation was about, it was something to the effect that I should have been better behaved. And I explained to my mother and the teacher that so-and-so was misbehaving. So remember the sister. She was a very frank individual. And she said, in my mother's presence, if others are going to hell, do you want to imitate them and go to hell yourself? Well, I hadn't heard it put so bluntly before. No, I said, I didn't want to go to hell. Now, I might have questioned the first premise of the sister, that my fellow students who misbehaved were going to hell. But I was young yet. So so it stuck with me. And I've used that advice ever since. Not put it in just those words, but they've got their conscience, their responsibility, you have yours. They have to be told, and they may not know it until they take their first vows, that there are good religious, not so good religious, and bad religious. And let's hope that your community has no bad religious. But if it does, admit it. You can always add, God judges the human heart. But as far as we can tell, this person is not living a good religious life. So, firmness. You have your grace to be faithful to. On the last day, you're going to be judged by your grace, not by that person's. And finally, discernment. A very difficult virtue. It is a form of the virtue of prudence. Discernment between fervor and dedication. The more demands are made on the people, as they should be in the postancy and novitiate, the more faithful they are, the more liable the people are to mistake their fervor, which is partly God's grace and partly their fidelity to the religious life, and real dedication. Try to make it as clear as you can that the essence of dedication is in the will. The essence of fervor is in the emotions. Now, while I think in general that women are more subject to making this mistake than men, but men can make it too. The affective side of a woman's nature is generally more strong and intense than it is in a man. And consequently, it is more likely that a woman religious will be quite fervent than when the humdrum routine of religious life sets in, having become accustomed to the fervor that she experienced before, not having it now. She begins to suspect everything. What I'm telling you, by the way, is a carbon copy of what happens in another state of life, namely marriage. The first year or two or three years of marriage are the most difficult. Not because they're the most demanding, but they're the most dangerous. Because people are liable to take the first flush of fervor as what this state is all of life is all about. I think the best way to make the distinction is to keep going no matter how you feel. I am told that people develop certain ailments, certain disabilities, sometime after they take their first vows, which can be part of, you might say, human natures wanting both the kind of attention which they were necessarily given in their early years of formation and just the letdown of the work that is called upon to be done. So to keep going in spite of the lack of fervor and devotion even in prayer. The fourth area is problems. There are two principal problems, each with a cluster of sub-problems, that I think are met and must be somehow resolved in that formation period between first and last vows. First, the problem of mistaking what we've been talking about, but I want to make it as clear as I can here. The problem of mistaking external conformity with internal commitment. You don't have, once you take your first vows, someone breathing down your neck every 5 minutes, warning you of this, encouraging you on that, and making sure that you give evidence of being a good religious. And therefore it means the internal virtues must be developed as we've outlined them a few minutes before. Secondly, and this is the hard one, no one really knows how God does with the souls of those that he specially loves, and surely he specially loves religious. But it seems that God generally gives not more grace, but more, you might say, personally satisfying grace in the early years of the religious life. In other words, as the phrase goes, he tempers his wind to the shorn lamb. A mother deals with her baby differently than, say, once the baby begins to grow up. I have watched, and sometimes I can't even look, a youngster. Every day, 6 years old, must be 6 years old, a big lump of flesh being pushed around by the mother in a buggy. The kid ought to be walking. But prudent mothers make sure that while we're infants, we, as St. Paul tells us, we behave like infants. And there was no question of doing it on our own because we couldn't. We can't feed ourselves. We can't walk ourselves. We can't do anything. Now, without pushing the analogy too far, you follow the logic, though. God's grace seems to follow, in a supernatural order, the way his natural providence operates in the natural order. When we're younger, naturally, God makes sure that other people will do things for us. Quite a strain on their generosity, but after a while, they say to themselves and they tell us, you're big enough. The great day when we first tied our own shoelaces. Took our first bowl of oatmeal. By the way, I read in a book on child care that you should allow a minimum of a square yard around a baby's high chair to allow for droppings from either uneaten or discarded food. I had a wash that I couldn't believe my eyes. A perfectly good dish of food. You know what the baby does? Tips it over. Absolutely crazy. I had to tell myself, has it reached the age of reason? So that in the supernatural order too, God gives certain graces which I might call he spoils us. With the attention people give us, the consolation we experience, and oh, how could I ever be anything else but a religious? That feeling. But God then begins to give us graces that are different. And this, to misunderstand God's providence and his conferral of grace, a real problem. And to be able to recognize this new grace. And just because I don't like it as much, doesn't make it any less a grace. For some people, the essence of grace is consolation. What's a grace? When I'm consoled. You illiterate? Now, some distinctions. This is area number five, part number five. By distinctions, I mean certain things that should be separated, kept apart, in how you deal with different people during this very important, call it a period of supernatural adolescence. Between small communities and large communities, there are special problems and difficulties and advantages on both sides. Let me just mention one or the other with a small community and one or the other, both problem and advantage, in the larger community. With a small community, one of the built-in problems is the very close intimacy with which the young religious, young at least in the religious life, the close intimacy with which that person is living and as a consequence being influenced by others. I think it takes more self, you might say, realization, more spiritual maturity, I really think, to live in a smaller group than a larger one. There are many options available in a larger community that you don't have in a small one. What is an advantage of a small community? Well, if the other religious practice basic charity, they can give the kind of attention and affection in a good sense that the neophyte requires, like in a smaller family. Now, of course, the person can be spoiled, but at least to see the difference. In a large community, one advantage is the variety of people with whom I can identify or to whom I can relate. And remember, by becoming religious, we have not ceased to be social beings. I'm not sure whether this is universally true. I know it is often true. One of the hardest problems of a young religious, especially after taking their first vows, is a loneliness. They feel lonely. They feel lonely because in the nature of things, so many things they've been doing together, the communitarian aspect of religious life is, as it should be, emphasized up to first vows. Once they take their vows, they're pretty much at the mercy of what they get. So a large community has the advantage of having more people with whom I can relate, but then you see immediately the problem. Young religious, this is the first beginning, often, of a particular and dangerous friendship in the religious life, especially with an older, maternally inclined, the motherly type, who takes this religious under her wing, or under his wing for a fatherly type, and becomes a kind of, well, surrogate for the one who should be in charge of this formation. Number 6. There is a special need for religious formation after first vows because it normally takes much longer than the individual has already been in the community to resolve the character difficulties or development of character. In other words, when we speak of nature building on grace, or grace building on nature, we don't usually refer to the need for nature developing even as grace develops. In other words, the person's character normally takes much longer than the 3 or so years before first vows to develop sufficiently for grace to build on that personality. And this is where I believe part of the development of the religious life after first profession means development of the person's character as it has come into the religious community. Sometimes those in charge of formation make the mistake of supposing that each person is to somehow fit a preconceived pattern. But in one sense there's a preconceived pattern, but it is always assumed that preconceived pattern is according to the distinctive personality of the individual. Again, if this is number 7, there is special need for developing the religious life in a situation after first vows where the individual does not have the close supervision and constantly available counsel that are normally present during the early years. In other words, in one sense, a person may almost be set to, well, be born into the religious life when they take their first vows, because the situation is much different after having taken one's first vows. And consequently, when we talk about development of the religious life after first profession, we are not talking about the kind of development that took place before first profession. The available means, both natural and supernatural, I would say in one sense are much fewer after first profession than before. And consequently, I believe there is a special need for attending to the conditions in which the person is living after first profession, And when we talk about developing the religious life, I also think that much more should be written and much more should be reflected on as to how religious life after first profession is to be lived. Most of the writing and conferences and directives about formation have to do with formation before first profession. Don't you think so? Again, the development of religious life after first profession is a development which will have to cope with problems, difficulties, temptations, such as the religious has never, in most cases, experienced before first vows. The phrase I have is sudden exposure to the life of the active apostolate. And I think the best word to use is exposure. This tender plant, in one sense, has hardly enough time to even catch its breath, and all of a sudden it is exposed to all the vicissitudes that the apostolate demands. Brother?
Father, I think that is so important, so much so that I think it's very vital during the formation before profession that they be taught and explained the negative and the positive experiences that they might, or situations they might experience in the active apostolate, because so often these young people will leave and go from the vicariate into the and become very discouraged, mostly, I think, in many circumstances, by the conduct and action of the very professed members themselves.
Yes.
You know, they become very disheartened.
There are a few things about which St. Ignatius wrote more and more extensively to his own spiritual sons than this matter of the kind of life the religious is to live after first vows, which is one reason also why St. Ignatius did not do, and when we are obedient, we don't do, what most communities do after first vows. He required the religious to remain in a house of probation for years. The normal sequence, according to the mind of St. Ignatius, is at least 5 years after first vows not to engage in the active apostolate. Isn't that something? 5 years. Whatever number we're on, seven?
Mm-hmm.
Seven. The great need in dealing with the religious after first profession is to help the individual combine the interior life with active work. There are a dozen other things, but I consider this most fundamental. And I have found in by now dealing with several thousand religious that unless this has been somehow bridged, and the ora et labora of St. Benedict has been worked out during those early years between first and final vows, it will never be worked out. And you find people later on, 20, 30 years in the religious life, still struggling, either neglecting to do things they could in the act of apostolate because they want to, understandably, be devoted to the interior life, but they are so interior there, they might just as well be in a cloistered contemplative community and not doing the Lord's work. Or they become such activists that their prayer life practically disappears.
This concludes part one of Father John Hardin's talk on the development of the religious life after first profession. Part two is to be found on the following tape.